from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. 2 years ago, the Me Too movement exploded into view after investigative journalist Ronan Farrow published a story in The New Yorker about Harvey Weinstein's serial sexual assaults of actors and employees. In his new book, Catch and Kill, Farrow chronicles the great lengths Weinstein took to suppress the story, going so far as to hire former Mossad agents and Ukrainian operatives to surveil and intimidate him. I talked to him in October about his investigation of the now-disgraced Hollywood mogul and what it took to bring the story to light. And remember, since this is a previously recorded program, we won't be taking your live calls and emails. Stay with us. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his new book, Catch and Kill, journalist Ronan Farrow exposes the ways in which Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein and his associates attempted to block reporting on the sexual assault claims that engulfed him. But the biggest obstacle of all, as Farrow tells it, was his then-employer, NBC News, which killed his reporting on the scandal. Farrow eventually took his story to The New Yorker and later won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. Ronan Farrow joins us this hour to talk about the cover-up and obstruction he encountered as he reported this blockbuster story, and welcome back to Forum.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Delighted to have you here, and let's talk about, once you got on the case, there are revelations that are coming out even almost daily on this, particularly where Matt Lauer is concerned, and I wanted to first have you talk about the connection between Weinstein and Matt Lauer, because there is a definite connection there.
So the book is about bigger patterns than any one media organization, although it does focus on AMI, the parent company of the National Enquirer, which was one attack dog collaborating with Harvey Weinstein to suppress these allegations, and on NBC News, which also became something of an instrument of suppression on his behalf. It's really about our profession and the ways in which corporate and legal practices designed to sweep harassment and abuse under the rug rather than confront it can create a situation where serial abusers stay in power and where people potentially get hurt. And the democracy suffers, Michael, because you end up with a situation where news organizations are, you know, working at the behest of powerful interests and the truth gets distorted. And I talk about how that has ramifications for our political future as well. Obviously, that collaboration between Trump and the National Enquirer wound up being a significant factor in 2016.
That's where the catch and kill comes from, in fact.
It is.
And we're talking about, in this case, about seven women non-disclosure agreements that were hammered out with NBC over a period of time, although people like Noah Oppenheimer, who is the head of the operation, says these were not the case.
And the book is incredibly carefully fact-checked. It's very measured. It's very fair and even generous to those executives who made those decisions around the killing of the story. But I think the facts stand on their own. You know, myself and the fact-checking team on this are very confident in the reporting, and it's held up to and been reinforced now by scrutiny from a whole lot of other outlets. And that is the fundamental revelation here, that this was one of several companies that I report on in Catch and Kill that had a lot of secrets, and that those secrets created vulnerabilities as a powerful person laid siege to them and entreated them to kill this thing, and as they promised to do so.
Let's talk about that concept, Catch and Kill.
Mm-hmm. Catch and Kill is an old term in the tabloid world. It refers to acquiring the rights to a story, not in order to publish it, but in order to prevent its publication. And very often this happens with sort of mundane celebrity dirt. You know, the National Enquirer has been doing it for years, where they'd have something unflattering about an affair someone had and then withhold publication and scoop up the rights to whatever person's story was going to be told. And on behalf of that person, kill the story. It's usually in exchange for you know, such and such a celebrity will appear on the cover of the National Enquirer or another AMI publication or some other transactional exchange of that nature. What I uncover in the events that unravel in Catch and Kill is the way in which the Enquirer was engaged in this practice for Harvey Weinstein, which is a story I was able to break later in The New Yorker, and how ultimately that trail of clues led to the top, if you will, to the president's collaborations with the National Enquirer, which were very much of a piece with that. And in this book, I reveal several new cases in which there was pretty deep and substantial collaboration between Trump associates and the Enquirer.
You're talking basically about corporate cover-up, really, aren't you?
Well, these are all variations on a theme, right? The term catch and kill is used literally in one sense in the plot of this book, in the old school tabloid sense. It's about what the Enquirer was doing to bury stories. But it's also used figuratively in a broader sense to refer to all of the other ways in which news organizations can become instruments of suppression rather than of telling the truth. And, you know, this is of a piece with reporting I did on CBS News, where you had a chain of executives who were accused of misconduct and a chain of secret settlements to try to bury those claims of misconduct and a board that was protecting people and keeping them in jobs, even though they knew there were a lot of complaints. And what I document in this book is that that's bigger than any one network. That is a rot that prevents the public from seeing tough stories and jeopardizes the safety of people within the media world.
We're talking with journalist Ronan Farrow about his new book, but he's here with us for the hour, and we'll answer any questions you have. Noah Oppenheim, who I mentioned before, said you really didn't have enough on, let me say, I always say Weinstein, but it's Weinstein. I knew too many, you know, Stein with an E-I and Stein with a Y. Go back to Alan Shulman.
We love a Stein. We love a Steen.
Not
this particular Steen, perhaps, based on the available evidence of alleged misconduct.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you maybe about Jeffrey Epstein, but we can get to that perhaps
in due time. That's a Steen, too.
That's Epstein and Weinstein.
I know many, many wonderful Steens and Steins, and those are perhaps not on the wonderful end of the spectrum. I did do some recent reporting on Epstein.
Well, Oppenheim, I have his name pronounced right, I believe. He says you were motivated by an axe to grind. You were essentially wanting to defame NBC News, and your whole case is built on, let me quote him here, distortion, confused timelines, and outright inaccuracies.
You know, every story I do, several kinds of machines spin up to oppose the reporting. You get legal threats, which have come in this case from Matt Lauer, from NBC Universal's litigation department, from the National Enquirer and Dylan Howard, its top editor. You get efforts to block the publication of reporting, which we've seen in this case. Dylan Howard actually was able to prevail in threats to booksellers around the world. And in Australia, several major retailers, including Amazon Australia, banned the book for a time. It is now on sale thanks to demand and also outrage from Australians who also like the free flow of information. And you see kind of attempts to distort and undercut from the subjects of the reporting. And that was true with the Weinstein story. It was true in my CBS reporting or my reporting on Eric Schneiderman. I mean, over and over again, you kind of see these tactics.
Well, isn't it true that Rich McHugh, who worked with you, the producer, actually had a tape of Weinstein admitting sexual assault?
Well, I obtained that tape. And what Rich McHugh has done in recent days is come forward and say, you know, I saw this. It was a brutal shutdown of a story. I was ordered to stand down. I was ordered to not take a single call. Ronan and I were ordered to put a stop on all reporting on this. And that fundamentally is the answer to that critique. Look,
ordered by Rich Greenberg, I believe. Is that right?
Rich Greenberg, who's the head of the NBC investigative unit, who was adamant that he was not acting on his own steam, but on orders from his bosses, Noah Oppenheim, the president of NBC News, and Andy Lack, his boss, the head of the NBC News group. And this went up to the parent company above both of them, too. So all of this to say, you know, while it has been falsely asserted, you know, that we didn't have a lot of reporting. In fact, I had obtained this tape of Harvey Weinstein confessing not just to a crime but to a pattern of sexual assault. obviously that sort of shocked the conscience of the nation when it came out and was everywhere. But at the time, they didn't want to run that. We had multiple named women in every version of this story. We had a huge group of sources describing misconduct at Weinstein's companies, all of which formed the backbone of the piece that ultimately ran in The New Yorker. But it is a distraction tactic to talk about this question of did we have enough? Because the fact here is, if at any point NBC News had said, you don't have enough, we'd like you to get out more, there would be no issue. That's a perfectly fine journalistic response. What is not an appropriate or typical journalistic response, I think most journalists would agree, is don't take a single call on this. Cancel these interviews with rape victims. And happily, the outcome of this is pretty unambiguous, which is I took that same body of reporting that they claim was not newsworthy. And within a few weeks, it was a Pulitzer Prize-winning story at The New Yorker just by dint of taking it across the street to other
Yeah, you just went to The New Yorker and David Remnick, and then the rest is history, as we say. But you
and
also—
thank God for the bravery of the incredible journalists at The New Yorker. I mean, they never flinched, you know, where my previous bosses had internalized specious legal arguments from Harvey Weinstein, had I document in this book at least 15 secret calls with Harvey Weinstein where they had promised to kill the story, and they've now conceded those calls took place. They were receiving gifts from Harvey Weinstein. You know, I hope this is a cautionary tale that's bigger than this one story that illustrates how toxic it becomes for the free flow of information when powerful people band together to kill the flow of information, and how equally powerful a force for good it is when people like David Remnick and the editors at The New Yorker receive the same treatment, the same onslaught of threats, and say, no, we're going to stand up to it.
It's mainly the journalists, in fact, who come out looking like they have character in all this. There's some really bad folks that we're talking about and some craven folks that you portray with a great deal of depth, if I may say so. And also, it's also, it seems to me almost axiomatic that you learn from your book that, well, a listener recently sent me something that said, first they came for the journalists, I don't know what happened after that, you know, which really made me reflect a good deal. But I'm also reflecting on something else in your book, which is after you went to The New Yorker, after the story broke, and this becomes something out of a thriller film almost, you're followed by Black Cube, kind of Mossad operatives, you're under surveillance, you got Ukrainian operatives who are following you, you got European operatives. I mean, it's terrifying stuff. You're being essentially scoped out and followed like you're a criminal.
Right. And people kind of make that observation that it reads like a spy thriller. And in the one sense, that can sound like it's you know, a glamorizing characterization in retrospect. But in another, it's a reminder of how these exotic and underhanded tactics should be reserved for the realm of, you know, John Grisham novels. They should not be directed at real-life reporters trying to break stories. And we have the protections of the First Amendment in this country and of our criminal laws, and therefore, you know, I'm careful to have a sense of perspective and note that I was not in the situation that so many journalists in Pakistan or Russia or many other parts of the world are in, where they just wind up dead if they're reporting on powerful interests. That's
there are people coming at them with umbrellas, things of that sort, right?
Right, right. You know, that said, I feel it is an important story to tell, to look at the threats that get thrown at not just me, but a whole range of journalists in this plot, and to try to galvanize us all to say, no, enough. You know, powerful people should not be able to manipulate the press in this way and to intimidate journalists in this way.
Well, the enemy of the people is what the president calls the press now and journalists. I don't know if you need to go there, but there were a lot of stories about Donald Trump in that safe that were caught and killed, too.
Right. Donald Trump is a significant subject of the reporting in the book. And as I said, there's new revelations about the tactics that he used to subvert the press and turn it into an arm of his campaign, essentially. And AMI has, since all of these events I've reported on, signed a non-prosecution agreement where they have admitted that this was taking place, that they were collaborating with Trump associates to kill stories. And it is all emblematic of a wider moment of urgency where, as you say, we have authoritarian rhetoric weaponized against the press, you know, this characterization of us as the enemy of the people, where in fact journalism is the only explicitly constitutionally protected profession for a reason, and it's the lifeblood of our democracy to have free access to information that can't be fettered by the most connected and wealthy people in this country. And, you know, the book is a tribute to and a love letter to all the reporters who stand up in the face of that and stay strong, and all the sources who refuse to stop talking in the face of that.
Did Weinstein have, put it in the Vulgate, dirt on NBC executives? That appears to be the case. Not only that, but Matt Lauer had a great deal of power in all this, too. That was why I was trying to somehow make that connection between the two of them, because they were protecting Matt Lauer.
They were protecting a wider pattern of secrets than just Matt Lauer. I think that's important to note. You know, this company has continued to double down on euphemisms and what some of the people involved in these settlements have called outright lies about this pattern of concealment within the company, where they say, you know, this is, quote, enhanced severance, that they were just paying, you know, six and even seven figures to women with complaints about Matt Lauer and others within this company, complaints that were voiced at a high level in this company. I personally talked to executives who were well aware these women had these complaints. You know, and NBC News says that that is coincidental, and they just happened to be serially paying out women who just happened to have complaints. And that is what this very often looks like in corporations where I've documented these kinds of patterns. You know, at CBS, there's a similar practice. And similarly, you see people often digging in and saying, no, it's all a coincidence. But
I get back to Oppenheim, who said there were seven cases of payoffs. We looked into them all. Our legal team looked into them all. There was nothing untoward here. And
that's right. And you talk to people involved in those transactions, and they tell a very different story. And you look at the documentation and the circumstances of how these women were complaining, and it also tells a very different story. You know, when you're paying, for instance, an accuser of one of the individuals who was brought in to vet the Weinstein reporting after they killed it and then unkilled it, and there was an effort to kind of whitewash the process. They brought in a Dateline producer named David Corvo. And when you're paying someone like David Corvo's accuser, a woman who had said he serially sexually harassed her, close to $1 million as he's in the midst of supposedly reviewing the Weinstein story in earnest, you know, you get a sense very quickly of how these patterns of secrets collide with efforts to do impartial coverage of these same issues. And the end result was a situation where Harvey Weinstein was bearing down on a media outlet with arguments that they could not report on secret sexual harassment settlements that he had, because that would be, you know, a breach of his contract. It would be an enticement of these sources to violate their nondisclosure agreements. And then you have the media organization that is the subject of that pressure parroting the same argument and saying, you know, we have to protect these non-disclosure agreements. That's something that was told to us repeatedly, that it would be tortious interference is the sort of specious legal term that gets used in these cases.
They were going to come after you with full bore in terms of legal. There was threats from almost the beginning of your investigating.
Yeah, threats that came at me, at the various news organizations that worked on this. There were some pretty ugly tactics, and I quote substantially from those legal threat letters where Harvey Weinstein intimates that he has a deal with NBC. He says he has received written assurances from them that they will terminate the story and assert a copyright claim if I take the material anywhere else. He weaponizes all sorts of personal stuff about my sister, who had a sexual abuse allegation, about an uncle of mine who I'd never met but was convicted of pedophilia. You know, sort of irrelevancies, but ones designed to unsettle and destabilize.
So what do you think is going to happen to Weinstein? He goes on trial in January.
He does.
And I mean, no tea leaves here, but what do you suppose will happen?
Yeah, I mean, no tea leaves is right. I am a reporter, not an activist, and I can't say what the disposition of the specific legal process on these specific charges.
Forgive me, but you have created a whole activist movement, however, called the Me Too movement. You've been behind a great deal of the, shall we say, the force of that movement.
Well, I take that as a tremendous compliment, because I have a lot of admiration for the activists who work on that, including Tarana Burke, who coined the term Me Too, who, it should be noted, had been, you know, working in the trenches as a community organizer on this and with trauma victims, and had been promulgating the term for years before this reporting. But to the extent that this reporting and that of, you know, a group of other reporters who cracked important stories in recent years on this front, to the extent that it galvanized that movement, I find that to be an honor and a totally appropriate way in which journalism can inform activism. But they're still very separate jobs. You know, my job here is to ruthlessly and rigorously interrogate the truth and be adversarial and skeptical. And I think it's very clear in the book that I am at every step and I'm willing to go where the facts may lead me. And if those facts, once disclosed, inspire a conversation about the need for accountability, I think that's the way journalism should work in this country.
We're talking with journalist Ronan Farrow about his new best-selling book, Catch and Kill. And again, he'll be making an appearance this evening at the Presbyterian Church, the Calvary Presbyterian Church in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. In the meantime, you can talk with our guest if you would like to or bring up questions or comments that are on your mind. And you can give us a call right now at our toll-free number. That number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. And let me repeat it for your calls, 866-733-6786, toll-free. You can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions that you might have or anything that's on your mind to forum@kqed.org. At this point, not being an activist, but being a journalist and being an investigative journalist who has obviously very high standards, what are your suggestions along the muckraking lines? I mean, what needs to be done? Because we're talking about a kind of complex of power that is really hegemonic in many respects. I'll use that fancy word, but I'm saying of extraordinary power.
I think that's right. And I do think that good investigative journalism is at the heart of what can break through those conspiracies of silence and that hegemony, to use your term, of powerful interests that mutually protect and suppress. And you know, every time I break a story, I'm very moved to say that brave sources continue to come forward. And in the wake of this book coming out, I've been inundated with leads of all sorts of types, including ones that, you know, directly reinforce the reporting in this book. And it's never just about me. It's a whole community of reporters that are refusing to stop here.
Well, you did put yourself sort of in the middle. I know that was uncomfortable for you in this book, right?
It was uncomfortable. And I'm very forthright in the book about the struggle over not wanting to do that, you know, wanting for the story to stand its own on its own. I think particularly because of my own background, which was very much, you know, in the shadow of celebrity and scandal. I write in the book about wanting desperately for the substantive work that I do to not be subject to those distractions and to stand independently. And, you know, the nature of the plot was that my personal life and who I was and my background were thrown at me, and all of that was used as a cudgel. So, like it or not, you know, Harvey Weinstein and others who I go up against in this book really used myself and my past against me.
You're listening to a special holiday edition of Forum from our archives. Stay tuned for more of my previously recorded conversation with journalist Ronan Farrow, author of Catch and Kill: Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to a conversation we're having with author and journalist Ronan Farrow, who has a new book out. It's called Catch and Kill, and there's an opportunity for you to speak with the author, any questions or comments you might have. We indeed welcome your involvement in the program. You know, Hillary Clinton and her daughter Chelsea were in town just yesterday, and I think you talked about, you, at one point, in fact, you worked with her, of course.
For several years.
For a number of years. You were talking about her lack of support as gut-wrenching, lack of support. I think that's the phrasing you use. Talk about that. Why did you feel unsupported by her, and do you still?
Well, so I'm very measured about Hillary Clinton's role in the plot of Catch and Kill, as I am in each aspect of the book. And you know as well as I that anytime you mention Hillary Clinton, it quickly gets transported into partisan headlines and sensationalized a fair bit. The reality of her role is quite minimal. She was part of a series of interviews that I was doing with every living Secretary of State for my previous book, which we discussed about a year ago, War on Peace, which is about...
Which is a fine book as well.
Thank you. Thank you. And a lot of brave whistleblowers made that book possible, too. And it was about the chaos at the State Department and the militarization of American foreign policy and the consequences of that around the world. And Hillary Clinton had been extremely supportive of that project and had known about it since I had worked at the State Department first... on Afghanistan policy and in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then reporting to her as an expert on youth uprisings, and had committed to doing an interview, and we had set a time frame for that interview. And there is a portion of the plot of this book in which the walls are kind of closing in a whole number of ways. And I include an anecdote about Hillary Clinton attempting to back out of that interview. And it comes after her flack, her spokesperson, Nick Merrill, calling to say, we're concerned about this big story you're working on. And, you know, that really is the totality of the facts, that there's a strange conversation where her team is concerned and has learned at a time when it is supposed to be secret that I'm working on this, that I am working on the story. Hillary Clinton was at the time very close with Harvey Weinstein. He was one of her big bundlers of Hollywood money and had supported her for many years, and she had described him as a friend. And they were at the time planning to collaborate on a documentary about Clinton. And that planning continued for months, deep into the fall, you know, essentially up until right before these allegations became public. And Hillary Clinton has faced complicated questions, I think correctly so, about how much she knew, and was it appropriate that she continued to work so closely with Weinstein and associate with him so closely? People like Tina Brown and Lena Dunham, and I've talked to a number of others in this category, have said publicly, we told the Clinton campaign that Harvey Weinstein had a reputation for predation on women. You know, these are on the record statements that high profile people have made, that they tried to warn Clinton's staff going back to 2008 and before. And so I think the questions are valid as to whether Hillary Clinton should have maybe thought twice about that alliance sooner. That said, I can't speak for her state of mind. You know, it's not accurate to say that she, you know, was a hands-on assassin of the Weinstein story, which plenty of people were. I include it as an indication of the fact that, you know, it was a gut punch each time a powerful person seemed to find me radioactive as a result of this reporting. And that was a moment in which the news of what I was doing was seeping into political circles of power, and I seemed to be losing opportunities as a result with each passing day.
There was a number of pictures put together kind of in a composite that went viral. You probably may have seen it. I know probably many of the listeners have. It has Bill Clinton giving the Medal of Honor to Harvey Weinstein, and then in another segment, it's him giving the medal to Bill Cosby, and in another segment, him giving the medal to Anthony Weiner, and so it goes. I can't imagine to what extent Hillary Clinton must be sensitive to those kinds of criticisms, particularly all the money that went into her campaign from somebody like Weinstein.
Well, here is the difficult thing about the conversation about Hillary Clinton, about whom there is certainly much to admire in her legacy. You know, she, I think, faces those questions in a valid context where there is actual documentation of her team having been told about Harvey Weinstein being an issue, and it doesn't appear that she did anything. And indeed, after that conversation with Nick Merrill, where he said, you know, we know you're working on this story, in other words, presumably he knew that there were some bad allegations about Harvey Weinstein, they did continue to advance conversations with him about that documentary for months and months. And Harvey Weinstein was meanwhile using that documentary as kind of a bartering chip as he was trying to entice NBC into various deals. There's a paper trail of emails about that in the book. So all of this is, you know, part of a pattern that I think illustrates how when powerful people cover for each other, people can continue to get hurt, and alleged predators can use that coverage as part of their arsenal as they try to suppress these allegations. You saw a very similar set of circumstances around how Jeffrey Epstein leveraged his relationships with prestigious universities to kind of cloak himself and shield
himself. With MIT and with Bill Gates, for that matter.
That's right. But you know, the point that I wanted to make in addition to all of that about Hillary Clinton is she is also subject to, I think, not at all rational questions that are very much about the shifting of blame from her husband, who does face, I think, very credible allegations of sexual assault onto her. I think she faces a lot of misogyny and a lot of kind of overheated and cooked up critiques that are not rooted in that set of facts. So this is one of those many difficult situations where there is both, you know, rank sexism thrown at Hillary Clinton. She has weathered so much, forgive me, BS in her career. And also, there are very valid, sober questions to be asked about her complicated relationship with Harvey Weinstein.
As you said, you're very measured. It was navigated.
You and I think, both try to strike that tone in our coverage, and there is unfortunately no way to make sure that that tone and that measured nature of the conversation follows through to the headlines that get spun out around reporting like this. It's just an impossibility. But for people who listen to a conversation like this in full, they will understand that complicated array of facts.
One can hope, and they will understand the nuances. And I want to ask you about a really wild story about Igor Ostrovsky, but we got callers, and let me go to them. And let's begin, Catherine, with you. Good morning. You're on.
Good morning. Thank you for having the show. I just wanted to thank you for writing the book.
Thank you, Catherine.
Excuse me. I'm a victim of that system many, many years ago. But I really appreciate what you're doing. I'm sorry I'm emotional in this phone call, but what you've done is really unbelievable. And for a woman that was a victim, I appreciate you so much.
Catherine, I'm not meaning to pry, but I understand you did some work in Hollywood, didn't you, and were a victim there?
Yeah, I was employed in L.A. in the 1980s, and I was a film editor.
Yeah, I would like to hear your story, and I know Ronan would too, but we've got a terrible line here. Maybe we can get you to call back to us. But you've heard a lot of those kind of remarks, I know, Ronan, people, especially women, telling you how much your work meant to them.
Well, I have to thank Catherine for calling in and being so candid and talking about such a difficult issue and such a personal one, you know, in such an open and public way. Thank you, Catherine, for being strong in that way. And it means the world to me anytime someone says that the work has helped to galvanize them in some way and helped to open up a space where they can openly confront things in their own past. I can't take credit for that. That's very much down to these incredibly courageous sources, you know, who we've seen speaking out in industry after industry about issues of sexual violence and harassment. And that's, you know, men in some cases now, but in the cases of these particular stories that I was working on, it was almost exclusively women. And, you know, the bravery of those women, especially in the portions of the plot of this book before the stories were breaking and when it seemed unthinkable that if they spoke, they would actually be heard. I just will spend the rest of my life feeling grateful for them, as I think reporters tend to feel grateful for sources who put a lot on the line to make the reporting possible.
And I thank Catherine for that call and go right to another caller, and that's you. Philip, join us. You're on.
Hello, Mr. Farrell.
Hello.
I've read your book. Hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yes. I read your book probably the day it came out. I didn't realize it was the day it was issued. It took me 2 days to read it. I couldn't put the thing down. And I'd known about this thing about Harvey Weinstein a little bit from the news, but what I didn't know and what shocked me was the amount of effort that he put into trying to quash this by using a Israeli security service with ties to the Israeli intelligence in order to quash this and put this down. And that was what really shocked me. But I have to say, I really commend you for the book. The book was fantastic. I hope you keep this up. You keep up your journalism and you keep working on this as much as you can. And I do have to agree with some of your associates who say that you should maintain your personal safety and security, because reading of what these people did, I think you really need to maintain that.
Yeah, let me thank you for that call. In fact, I'm looking at a tweet here from Sarita, who says, your revelation about Weinstein using Black Cube private investigators is opening my eyes to the involvement of third parties to kill stories. How pervasive is these kinds of cases and in politics?
Too pervasive, very pervasive. And thank you, Philip, for those kind words. It means a lot after, you know, laboring kind of in the darkness with your fingers stained in ink, scribbling drafts of a thing and working with sources who were terrified and putting a lot on the line and, you know, dealing with the onslaught of legal threats and sort of smears in the press that accompany each of these stories. It's then very gratifying to hear people say, you know, I can't put it down. And also it's had some impact on my thinking. And you're right. A significant theme in this book is the prevalence of these sort of extreme tactics that seem almost stranger than fiction, deployed by powerful people to shut down reporting on them. And the private investigation world, you know.
Well, I'd ask you about, I mentioned sort of as a tease, the Igor Ostrovsky story. Could you go into that?
Yes. The private investigation world comes under scrutiny in this reporting a lot. And there's clearly valid applications of those services and also ones that I think are very over the line. And I would say, you know, this particular case, the tactics correctly are being regarded as over the line by a whole lot of people reacting to the reporting. One of the things that Harvey Weinstein did was he retained Black Cube, the firm that we've been talking about, an Israeli private intelligence firm skilled in using false identities and front companies. And they sent out multiple operatives, one of whom was posing as a journalist, and trying to pump other journalists and also sources for information under that guise, one of whom was a woman who used a whole slew of false identities to pose as, for instance, you know, a traumatized victim of Harvey Weinstein, and in another case as a wealth manager from London with a passion for women's rights activism, who eventually, under that false identity, became Rose McGowan's best friend, an actress with an allegation that they were trying to obtain information about. You know, and when you have a situation where a human intelligence operative with a background in the Israeli military is playing the role of someone's best friend while secretly recording them and sending audio back to that person's alleged rapist, you know, I think it's correct that people are asking questions about how far is too far. Another tactic that I document in the book is that Harvey Weinstein, through Black Cube, was tracking and surveilling both reporters and sources in these stories. And one of the plot threads that runs through the book is the mystery of Igor Ostrovsky, who you mentioned, and Roman Hykin, two private investigators who occasionally kind of have a Keystone Cops-esque comedy of errors kind of role in the plot. But, you know, they are sent out to stake me out and chase me around. And for all the ways in which they sort of fail to ascertain what's happening to my story and to intimidate me, they also do have some success. You know, on the one hand, they run around for a while chasing a neighbor who looks like me, and there's, you know, a reveal of, oh, it's actually not me. It's just some other blonde dude that they're running around after.
This is Keystone Cop stuff, like you said.
Right. And then on the other hand, they do successfully track my cell phone location. You know, they get accurate GPS data and are able to trail me to the offices of The New Yorker at a time when Harvey Weinstein is desperately trying to find out where I've taken the story after he feels he's successfully moved NBC to kill it. So on the one hand, I try to keep it in perspective and not overstate how bad this stuff is, because like I said, we are in the United States and there are basic legal protections that I might not have had if I were reporting this elsewhere. On the other hand, this is serious stuff, and it is alarming when you have sources saying you've got to get a gun and you're moving out of your place, as I do in the plot of this book and did in real life. And you're looking over your shoulder a lot and realizing people are following you. And maybe it's not a conspiracy theory. It's just an actual conspiracy. And thankfully, through the bravery of a lot of sources, I'm able to document just how real it was and, you know, all the contracts behind it and everything. Those are all in the book and all the parties involved admitted. One of those brave sources is actually one of the guys who was following me around, who is moved by his own background growing up in the final days of the Soviet Union in a police state type environment where powerful people control the press, to want to stop that from happening in America, where he's building a life and a family. And so that those stories of kind of profiles and courage and people who stand up even within these plots and try to stop them really form the backbone of Catch and Kill. And I hope people find it optimistic as a result.
Well, you certainly give plaudits to those people who had courage, and you had a great deal of courage because you were facing a good deal of adversity. I have to ask you, though, did it also give you a thrill? I mean, you went after some pretty powerful people here in your work and brought them down, one could argue.
I would like to say no, but it's an interesting question that runs through a lot of different types of work that have kind of a, you know, a high octane quality occasionally. Like, there's a lot of literature, obviously, about war reporters and, you know, doctors working in war zones, kind of getting hooked on adrenaline. And I don't know that I know myself well enough to know whether there's a component of that. I certainly don't feel conscious of it. You know, it doesn't feel like I would ever seek out these kinds of situations. They more just sort of have happened to unfold around these stories. I certainly didn't, you know, invite that kind of surveillance around the
Weinstein
story.
You've kind of gone where your gifts are, too. I mean, that is the way life sometimes
Right. I mean, I would like to think that it's much more, you know, this is where the reporting needs to happen, and therefore I have to be in these situations. But it is also true, you know, there was that moment that went viral recently of a reporter asking Meghan Markle, you know, are you okay? How are you doing? And people sort of just being bowled over by that simple act of compassion. Like, oh, you can ask a public person, you know, even though they have tremendous privilege, you know, are they doing okay? And, you know, our caller who was so lovely just now asking about making sure that I had security is, I think, in the same vein. I don't think I'm hooked on it in the way that you suggest, to the best of my knowledge about myself. But it is true that it's been a long run of fairly stressful, you know, adversarial, high-stakes reporting jobs. You know, I broke a whole sequence of stories that really involved going up against a lot of this complicated machinery, and I probably do need a vacation at some point, Michael.
Oh, I would commend you to do that. We're talking to Ronan Farrow, and by the way, if you'd like to join us in the time remaining, the toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Here's Beth, who says, curious why folks like George Clooney, who is married to a human rights lawyer, isn't being called out for not doing more to stop folks like Weinstein, since he admits he heard rumors from many people about Weinstein's behavior.
Well, I don't know enough about what George Clooney knew and when, and what his working relationship with Harvey Weinstein was, so I can't comment on that specifically. I certainly think highly of Amal Clooney and her work as a human rights lawyer. And I would say more broadly that it is correct, I think, that we're in this moment where we are calling upon public figures to use their platform and their voice and the statements they make implicitly through who they work with to make sure that these kinds of alleged crimes don't go unnoticed. You know, we've seen an outpouring of people in Hollywood say, I'm not going to work with someone who is credibly accused of serious crimes of this kind. And I think that that ultimately is a good and healthy thing. You know, I tend to not get into the conversation about, can you consume an artist's work with a clean conscience if, you know, if they're accused of really serious crimes. I tend to be more pragmatic about caring about the decisions when they actually help prop up someone or elevate their profile. So, you know, I'm not particularly invested in whether you watch a late night rerun of Chinatown. You know, Roman Polanski is a convicted sexual abuser of an underage person. I am invested in, I think, the, you know, the actors who would choose in the present day to work with Roman Polanski or Bill Cosby and on like this. So the fact that George Clooney, from what you're saying, has talked about this issue and knowing rumors, I think is already a really healthy sign.
Here's Katie. Katie, join us. You're on the air.
I want to thank Ronan for his work and all the Me Too people. 50 years ago, I was date raped by a doctor, and there was no such thing as date rape, and I carried that for decades. Mm-hmm. And now with Ronan and Me Too, I feel better every day. Thank you.
Thank you for that call. That's, again, I'm sure good to hear.
It's incredibly moving, and just thank you for saying that. And I do think that actually we are still in a moment where it's new to have people talking so openly about this stuff, and I think it's really a service to every person still struggling with whether to come forward. And the reason all of this is important is in so many of these cases, I'm able to document how when people are stifled and don't come forward and problems are paid out to make them go away and there is no accountability, people can continue to get hurt as a result.
Well, here's
a
question.
So thank you to everyone calling in.
What you just said, yeah. From Vince, who says, if voice silencing, non-public record, non-disclosure agreements were prohibited for these things, would that not help the situation a lot?
So there is a complicated conversation happening now and much overdue, I think, about how legislatures address these issues of whether non-disclosure agreements, which have a lot of perfectly valid applications. I'm an attorney, and I would never say something as crazy as there should be no non-disclosure agreements. There's all sorts of protecting trade secrets and so forth, valid reasons to use them. That said, I think that it's a really fair conversation that's happening where states are, in some cases, deciding we are no longer going to allow the use of non-disclosure agreements with respect to allegations of sex crimes. I think that's healthy. I think the reassessment of these legal structures in the world of private industry is really healthy. You've seen companies like Uber that have had harassment problems come forward and say, we're not going to use NDAs in this context anymore. And obviously, there's incredible journalists at NBC News and other places reported on in the book who are now asking those same questions within their own organizations.
You sound hopeful about reforms now, some that have taken place and some on the horizon.
I do feel a tremendous amount of hope. I mean, people ask me, you see in so many of these cases leadership at companies with problems digging in and refusing to acknowledge a problem. And, you see continued crimes and cover-ups. But so much of this story in this particular book is also about how these sources are unstoppably courageous. And there's a whole community of reporters who aren't stopping. And I don't think the conversation about reform is stopping either, no matter how much people dig in.
Catherine is our next caller. Catherine, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Hi. My comment, which may not come out as eloquently as I'd hoped, is earlier you were talking about the protection of free speech and the hard work of the journalists and journalism in general and the jeopardy that we have with our current president and his attack of it. But I also feel like it's been on the attack and people have been exhausted predominantly through tabloids and their unethical search for information on anyone famous and their willingness mm-hmm. to go and read mail and tap their cell phones. I mean, the whole thing around the royal family and about certain stars. And so there's this blurring where we feel we want our journalists like yourself to do the hard work and make people aware of what's happening, like with the Weinstein story, but at the same time, protect the privacy of individuals.
It's a really important point.
And a fair point.
And a very fair point, and one that is at the heart of Catch and Kill, I mean, which is named after a tabloid journalism practice that's quite nefarious for a reason. And obviously, the book is not kind to that world of tabloid journalism used as an attack mechanism to destroy people. It's something that was directed at me over the course of this plot, and it's something that I show can be part of the dynamic that turns the press into an instrument of suppression. I mean, that I guess is what I would say, that the tactics that you describe in the tabloid world very often are on the unjournalistic side of the ledger.
Well, not only in suppression, but, I used to notice, for example, in the supermarket, the tabloid headlines in American media, David Pecker's National Enquirer, there would be these vilifications of Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. and all of these extraordinary panegyrics, for lack of a better word, yeah. of Donald Trump. I mean, they were consistent. I found myself asking, what did Pecker and company get out of this? What was their payoff?
Well, the book looks at that in some detail and quotes a lot of brave people within AMI who became sources talking about exactly that, you know, that Pecker gets on Trump's plane over the years. Pecker gets to cloak himself in the prestige of political power now. You know, in the time frame described in the book, he winds up dining at the White House and being connected.
So it was just those kind of perks, really, that mattered. There wasn't anything specifically in terms of a payoff that you were able to glean.
That's right. It's a whole set of perquisites up to and including, you know, in the same time frame, people around Trump connect Inquirer leadership to potential sources of Saudi funds. You know, they're able to tap into international circles of power and funding.
Yeah.
Well, that is real. That, you know, there's the whole trail of the Times and other outlets have done reporting on this. A lot of this reporting is in Catch and Kill. They wind up at White House dinners and then soon after engaged in conversations with the Saudis about funding.
You're listening to a special holiday edition of Forum. My guest was New Yorker magazine reporter Ronan Farrow, author of Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators. I spoke with him back in October. Stay tuned for another show from our archives. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.